Okay, let's open with a word of prayer again. Father, we thank you for your incredible love. We thank you for the way you broke into history in the person of your Son and communicated your love and communicated the abject sufficiency of your work for us, your sacrifice on the cross. At a very, very deep level, the cross was something between you and your Son. He was not, quote-unquote, our sacrifice. It wasn't anything we did. But you made a provision for us like you did in the Old Testament. You told them in Leviticus that you had given the blood on the altar as an atonement. It wasn't anything we did, even that whole symbol system. And so we are awed by the fact of your initiative in our lives, your persistent, the aggressiveness of your warmth, the invasion of your kindness, that it's not a passive thing, that you are after us. You pursue us with your love. We would ask that today we would understand more about your heart, that we would see the difference that you make in lives. So open our hearts to your word and to the lessons from it, that we may come away with a greater appreciation for you and the gift of your Son. We ask this for his sake. Amen. Okay, we are in the, we're toward the end of the introduction. We're getting closer. Somebody asked me last night at the Discovery Publishing Party, do I anticipate finishing the introduction before the Lord's return? And I said, well, one, I hope not. That's a separate issue. But that theoretically we should finish most of the introduction in the next 2 weeks. But I'll be lecturing on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of this week. So if you miss that, we won't get through it. We are, of course, in the backdrop of the work of Christ. We are in the Old Testament. We're talking about how God set the stage, how he literally arranged the sacrificial system, and it had its short-term significance for Israel. We'll look at some of the differences. It was different than that around them. But this elaborate stage was set so that when the Son of God walked on to history, one said, wow. This wasn't your standard manual laborer from Galilee that walked into history. But here was the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And we would not have understood a lot of that had we just been regular sacrifice people. Let's put it this way, Mesopotamia and Egypt, we looked at a bunch of those. And we are in the section today, we started last week, on the differences. What we did was we studied, of course, the Old Testament. We studied the background of how sacrifice was done through the world, early cultures. And then as a contrast for the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, we divided it into three parts. We looked at the prescriptions given in Deuteronomy, the first five books of the Bible, the Law of Moses. We looked at what God said to do, how the rituals were all laid out. We looked at the book of Psalms, how the worshiper felt about this. Which ones did they concentrate on? We pointed out it was the thanksgiving ones. These were the ones that got the most attention. And in the third one we looked at, the third category we finished up, was that on prophetic rebuke. And this was when the prophets, as this became more institutionalized and it lost its first love, so to speak, how it just got sort of twisted around and became meaningless and actually became destructive, counterproductive. We looked at these things. And then we switched in to try to summarize what we've discovered in the past couple of months in terms of the essential differences between the Old Testament law and sacrifices and that of the neighboring countries around Israel. And the first one we pointed out, page 10, was that there was no real atonement in the other systems. The issue was good fortune or bad. In other words, are things going well for me or not? Anytime something bad happened to me, it was time for a sacrifice. It's a little trigger point. And so it was not an issue of real communion with God. It wasn't a personal relationship per se. It was just strictly how things were going. How's life treating you kind of thing. Okay. Two, not an attempt to manipulate the God. We pointed out that was very verboten in the Old Testament. God abjectly forbid this, absolutely forbade that. He consistently wouldn't even let them build an image, remember, a model of him so that he could feed and clothe and wash him, all the stuff that they did in the other religions. Wouldn't let him do that. He said, I'd rather you spend that time on other people. Three, no care in feeding of Yahweh. We talked about that. He had that great craze where he says, if I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you. Remember that one? We talked about that one. We got into the ethical versus magical in nature. And that ethical meant that there was a moral element to this, as opposed to just sort of practical or magical, I could manipulate God. Remember we read that thing from the Mesopotamian about you could train your God to trot after you like a dog, right, by withholding the sacrifices. And you can also, and if you do the sacrifice, you can build up a credit balance with him, and you can go foreclose on God, you know, if he doesn't pay off in terms of good benefits and things of this type. And that was for ancient Near East. I've got a couple more to read to you today on the magical part. Five was more detailed and centralized than the ancient Near East. Remember, all the way through the Old Testament, the people of Israel, lots of them, were still idolaters. They would offer sacrifices in the fields to the goat idols. Later, of course, they did human sacrifice. They were always in constant state of a spectrum of idolatry. Sometimes Yahweh was not even in their list of appropriate gods. Sometimes he was just sort of the head god, and I still worshiped ancestors, other deities, etc. Right? And so this was this common range. I might say it's not altogether different today. We just don't call them actual gods. We have different little things, but that's a personal issue that we deal with. And so this was more detailed and centralized. God was trying to put some kind of structures in this, where the system was self-reinforcing. We talked a little bit about that. And we're at 6 today, about simplicity and balance, the extremes of Ugarit and Mesopotamia. Now, Ugarit is what we would call Syria, Palestine. So the land of Palestine was Ugarit, the Canaanites. Ugarit was the largest city in that, and they had the very elaborate culture and things of this type. They practiced routinely human sacrifice, sexual prostitution, sacred prostitution. They had a lot of cutting themselves and self-mutilation in their practices and things like that. Very strong kind of, you know, visceral kinds of practice. Whereas over Mesopotamia, remember, they were sacrificing potatoes. You know, it wasn't quite as violent, but it had this very low, you know, they still did lots of it, and it still had all the elaborate aspects of it, but it's just such a wide range. And it's so different compared to our religion of the Old Testament, the sacrificial. Now, what I brought in today, I have two incantations I want to read you. Just to illustrate that the deities were just almost like petty. They were just, you were always confronted with some angry god. Half the time you didn't know which one it was or who it was. And there are two incantations from about the period that this is being written. The first I've alluded to before, and it's the prayer called To Any God. And it's a form letter. It's a form prayer. And down at the bottom, there's a subscription on the document that says, according to its subscription, this bilingual address, it's written in two languages, Akkadian and Sumerian, this bilingual address consisting of a prayer, confession, lament, and concluding supplication could be used for any deity. So there was a little prayer written in two languages that applied to any god that was after you. And you could use this. And it starts out, and it's a series of four kinds of things. It starts out, may my Lord's angry heart be reconciled. May the God I do not know be reconciled. In other words, there's a God that he does know and a God that he doesn't know. May the goddess I do not know be reconciled, just in case it's a female deity that's upset. May the God, whoever he is, be reconciled. Okay. May the goddess, whoever she is, be reconciled. May my personal God's heart be reconciled. May my personal goddess's heart be reconciled. May my God and my goddess be reconciled with me, in case it was a squabble between those two deities up there, because we humans always got caught in intermarital disputes between the god Zeus and Hera. You know, we're always getting sort of caught in the shrapnel there. May the God who has turned away from me in anger be reconciled. May the goddess who has turned away from me in anger be reconciled. I do not know what wrong I have done. See, just all that, something bad had happened, right? A tree had fallen on the house. And so we don't know what I did wrong, but I'm going to pray to everybody about every possible thing, and surely I'm going to cover that, right? I do not know what wrong I have done. My God did not call my name with favor. My goddess did not call my name with favor. My God did not pronounce my name with favor. My goddess did not pronounce my name with favor. I could not eat for myself the bread I found. I could not drink for myself the water I found. In other words, I went out and earned food today, but I had to offer it to God to placate Him. See, I didn't get to eat today because I had so many gods that I had to try to pacify and buy off with my livelihood. So I had to go hungry today because they had to be fed so that I would win the lotto or something. I have perpetrated unwittingly an abomination of my God. I have unwittingly violated the taboo of my goddess. O my Lord, many are my wrongs. I don't know what they are. Great are my sins. O my goddess, many are my wrongs. Great my sins. O God, whoever you are, many are my wrongs. Great are my sins. O goddess, whoever you are, many of my wrongs, great are my sins. I do not know what wrong I have done. I do not know what sin I have committed. I do not know what abomination I have perpetrated. I do not know what taboo I have violated. Do you get the sense of helplessness here? Right? And there should be a growing frustration in this experience as well. A Lord has glowered at me in the anger of His heart. A God has made me face the fury of His heart. A goddess has become enraged at me and turned me into a sick man. A God, whoever He is, has excoriated me. A goddess, whoever she is, has laid misery upon me. I kept on searching, but nobody will help me. When I wept, they would not draw near. When I would make a complaint, no one would listen. I am miserable, blindfolded, I cannot see. Turn towards me, merciful God, as I implore you. I do homage to you, my goddess, as I keep groveling before you. O God, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. O goddess, whoever you are, turn towards me, I implore you. O Lord, turn towards me, I implore you. O goddess, look upon me, I implore you. O God, you know, you can see these, he's like putting up those little dolls. I'm thinking, just going through these, praying through these. How long, O my God, until your furious heart is calmed? How long, O my goddess, etc., etc. You go through the litany of these. And then it gets down to the end, it says, men are slow-witted and know nothing. Now, this doesn't mean this was written by a female. Okay, I think it's a generic use of men. Men are slow-witted and know nothing. No matter how many names they go by, what do they know? They do not know at all if they are doing good or evil. Right? Oh, my Lord, do not cast off your servant. He is mired in a morass. Help him. Turn the sin which I perpetrated into virtue. Let the wind bear away the wrong I have committed. Many are my crimes. Strip them off like a garment. And then it goes through, oh my God, oh my goddess, oh God, whoever you are, oh goddess, whoever you are, take these sins away from me. And as if you were my real mother, let your heart be reconciled. As if you were my real mother, my real father, let your heart be reconciled. And there's just this sense of I can't get there from here. You know, but you go through the motions, right? You go through the motions because it's got to be a magical thing. Somehow you got to get relief. It's not a, you know, you don't know this God. You don't know God personally. And so you don't know in your heart what you've already done that needs to be dealt with, unfinished business before God. Yeah.
Is this what Jesus was referring to when he said not to be like the heathen who think they'll be
free? Vain repetition, yeah. Because that was the practice in his day as well. They would have incantations on a consistent basis, even to the Roman deities. And they had, of course, full sacrifices to the Roman deities as well, all the festivals. But yeah, they would say things over and over and over to be heard for their much speaking. Right? You could just shout God down. It's like a filibuster. God would get tired eventually of you running at the mouth and give you what you want. Okay? And the other one was to show you a little bit of how petty, I don't want to misdo this, but just to show you how volatile these beings were. This is an incantation to calm a baby. Okay, and I made 20 copies of this, by the way, for those of you that want to take this home. Babylonian parents sometimes tried magic words to calm fretting and crying babies. Little one who dwelt in the dark chamber, this is back when you were pregnant, right? You really did come out here, and you have seen the sunlight. Why are you crying? Why are you fretting? Why didn't you cry in there? Okay. You have disturbed the household God. We've heard of them making so much racket that they wake the dead. This one woke the God. Okay, right? You have disturbed the household God, the bison monster, which was a buffalo kind of figure, water buffalo monster. You have disturbed the household God. the bison monster is the source saying, who is it disturbed me? Who startled me? The little one disturbed you. The little one startled you. Like wine tipplers, like a barmaid's child, let sleep fall upon him. Okay? And this was an incantation that they would use to try to get the kid to sleep. Whether this worked better than what we use, you know, aerosol cans of Valium. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Right? But somehow a baby could wake up the household god and would have to, you don't know who was worse, what was worse, waking up the household god or just dealing with the fretting kid, I suppose. But they had an incantation. The list of incantations on the table of contents are staggering. You know, they're love charms, of course, but dealing with an evil eye, there's sickness, constipation, there's an incantation for that. There's an incantation for dog bite, to keep a dog from biting you, and then there's a special one against fast dogs, so that the dogs that you run across will be slower dogs than other dogs, right? And you can see they're trying to work the system. You're just doing the best you can with what you got, right? So it has this magical component, this sort of orderly thing that you try to work through, but there's just no heart there, if you think about it. I mean, there's real, you know, you don't know this deity, you know, the altar to an unknown god. That's the story in Corinth, where Paul goes into the city, remember, and there's an altar that says to an unknown god. If you remember, the story is some 300 years before then, where a plague hits the city, and they sacrifice to all the known deities, and the thing stays there. The plague is still there. And then they said, well, you know, let's do an altar to an unknown deity. They offer a sacrifice, and the plague goes away. Right? The plague goes away to an unknown god. So Paul walks into the city and says, this one I declare to you today. The one you don't know has made himself visible. Walked right in on the stage of human history, and he has a name. He's got a birth certificate. He's got a death certificate. And he's still alive, and his body is somewhere still alive. Preach the resurrection. See? We don't know how all that works, but the body of Jesus Christ is still alive somewhere as we speak. See? And he looks a lot like he probably did. He's got some changed physical characteristics, but he still has some marks on him. And there's an old saying, remember his hands. Remember his hands, right? Okay, so simplicity and balance, is so much more sober in the Old Testament laws. 7, the Passover sacrifice has no analog in the ancient Near East. In other words, there's nothing sort of like the Passover, probably because there was no such thing as an Exodus outside of Israel. If you look at one of the statements that Moses gave them, has any God, Deuteronomy 6:34, has any God ever tried to take for himself one nation out of another nation by testings, by miraculous signs and wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, or by great and awesome deeds, like all the things the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes? See, we have military victories that are ascribed to pagan deities. Anytime somebody won, they say God was on our side, right? And so they would offer these monuments that said to the king of, you know, to Mesha, the king of Moab, who was blessed by Carchemish or whatever, you know, their deity type. And so they would do this. But you never have anything as radical as somebody literally going in and plucking a nation out. You just don't have that. That's, in many cases, without precedent in ancient history, period. Much less it being with such a disadvantaged people against such a powerful nation. That's just a little overkill. It's hard to explain that by other means. We do know historically what was going on roughly at the time. And there were reasons why the Pharaoh didn't want to let the Israelites go, but was concerned about them being inside, because he was concerned that they might be traitors, see, and they would be inside. And so he had to put them in abject subjection instead of using them as comrades. And so there's some historical things, but there's just no analog to the Passover sacrifice. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that that literally creates a new identity at all. 8 is that this was based on a special covenant relationship. It wasn't based on just sort of general religion or general religiosity. The Old Testament sacrifices were part of a very elaborate theological system. See? It was based upon the fact that God said, I give you my laws because we've made a deal. We've got a covenant. When we got up there, and he said, now here's my laws. Do you want to take them or leave them? Well, do you want them or not? Remember? And they said, yep, everything you said, we will do. And then Moses said, well, you better not say that. Better not say that. You sure you want this? Yep, everything the Lord said, we will do. No, you can't do this because if you do this, God will judge you and you won't do it. And blah, blah, blah. Everything he says, we will do. Now, they say that approximately 8 times in the Old Testament. Said, yep, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. We're going to do it. Everything he says, we're going to worship him only, etc. Right? And this was the foundation that they just made a commitment, just a theoretical commitment. I'm going to try to live for you, God. That starts this whole dance with God. This whole thing just starts with that feeble little intention that says, I need help, and I'm open to even you, God. I'm open to even you. I remember when God broke into my life, I was a college junior, and just miserable, just a worthless. It was worse than just miserable, just useless. Just useless. I wasn't brave enough to be spectacularly bad, but I was consistent enough to be spectacularly miserable. And it was just miserable. And it had vagueness about it, which is a separate problem. But I remember very distinctly the weekend that was a Thanksgiving weekend, November that year, that they used to have a little plaque that had a picture of like what we used to call hobos. You know, with the little stick and the little thing and the train, and said, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Right? And I was theoretically smart back in those days before, you know, people found out about later. And I was sitting in a big green easy chair one night, miserable, and the voice just sort of, you know, in the back of my head, inside my heart, just changed the little thing and said, if you're so smart, why aren't you happy? Yeah, just why aren't you happy? I mean, is there something else involved in you figuring all this stuff out and what the rules are, et cetera? Said, point well taken. Chair's out of order. Point well taken. And so in that vagueness that most non-Christians have, I fell backward into the arms of Jesus Christ and said, I know enough about you from the religion that I was brought up that I've got your name pinned down, and I've got this little booklet in front of me that my girlfriend gave me at the door when I took her into the dorm after the last frat party. What an insult and a half to be handed a religious tract at the door. God. And so I had this thing, you know, and I read it and made no sense. It used Protestant, general, Western civilization words. For righteousness and sanctification and holiness and all these things. I had no clue what that meant. Nothing. But there was some kind, I got the general impression that the answer was in Jesus somehow. And if I could just get to Jesus somehow. And had this little prayer at the back and didn't know what all I was asking for, what I was signing up for. But I said, hey, I messed it up. I don't even know. I didn't even know how bad I was. You don't learn that until you get older and older and older and older and older, that you learn what sin's about, you know, what evil's about, right? And so in that fog, I asked Christ to come into my life and do something. And they had the little pictures of the thrones and all this kind of, you know, the circles and all this weirdness. I had no idea what that meant, you know. I remember some of the Christian terminology we used. Remember the one about the ask Jesus into your heart? And I remember somebody pointed out, I said, well, if you had a heart transplant, would you lose your salvation? I said, gosh, it can't be that simple. You know, there's some, what do we mean by some of these phrases, right? And there's this vagueness, and I just fell into the fog. I fell into the fog, and then what truth and light sort of starts breaking. And then over the intervening 20 years, I have the illusion that the fog is a little clearer. And it is a little clearer because I feel a little more loved by my God. I've seen his heart a little bit better. And that makes all the difference in the world. And I'll stay there. I was thinking this morning about when my kids were little and they would get scared, they would come over and cling to your leg when they're like 2 and 3. And if you get in a public place and it's a place that they don't recognize, they'll just come just latch on, or they'll grab your skirt in the case of mom, you know, in some cases, and won't let you go. And we were in the time in my prayer where I was reminding God of his accountabilities to me. The ones, the things that I had committed to him decades ago to make sure happened. I hold him accountable every day for those couple of things, the big ones in your life, right? And I said, I'm like the widow of Shunammite, you know, the lady of Shunammite. I'm going to hold on to Elijah's feet and ain't going to let him go, right, until he comes and lays on my son and heals him, right? And so that clutch, you only do that if you trust that soul. You don't do that. You know, if my kids didn't, trust me, they wouldn't grab onto my leg. They'd pick somebody else's leg. Right? That's one of the times that they're not off running around doing other things anyway when we're out in public. You know, when they're excited and they feel comfortable, they go do this. But boy, you get in a threatened situation, you run to somebody you trust. Hold on there. Just grab it. There were two, I remember the word for faith. There's so many words for faith in different languages. And there's an old Latin word for it called repose, reposito, which is that repose word. You know, where you lay back in the big green easy chair and you in the arms of Jesus and just rest there. And then one of the sign language words for faith is, right? There are times you do that, right? Holding on to that rope, you know, and you're counting on that rope, right? And God has a different kind of faith for a sort of each day, each situation. Sometimes it's easy and sometimes it's tough. Sometimes you're clinging to that leg, right? And sometimes you're just laid back in that love. And those work because they're personal, see, because you have the heart of God. You know the heart of God. And as you get to know that, then you understand that that's not magic. It's not magic when I sit there and pray. He wants me to pray this way, right? Because he's trying to teach me that. It's not a magic thing. He's trying to teach me to be faithful or consistent or something like that, you know. And it's a parenting thing. It's not a matter. He's trying to teach me that magic works or the ritual works. Because I've tried that on him many, many times. That never works. In times that he would normally bless, he's got to teach me rituals don't work, Glenn, so I can't honor it this time. I've got to teach you to be honest every day. Every day we get up new. Every day. Let's say, where are we, God? So, this was based on a special relationship that all these laws flowed from that. 9, inclusiveness of lay worshipers as well as foreigners. Now, remember we commented a number of times that almost all of these things were done by priests, official state priest in the various religion things, except in Israel. And in Israel, we had a couple of places where it was very, very inclusive. We talked about the Nazarite vow last week, of number 6, that men and women, rich or poor, no exclusions, anybody, foreigner, could have the consecration at the level of the high priest. Remember, we talked about the high priest had a ceremony to consecrate them, and the closest to that ceremony was a ceremony for the Nazarite. Of all the ceremonies of purification, and that any of us, regardless of whether we were related to Aaron or not, could have that level of closeness in terms of service to God. A couple of verses about the inclusiveness, an alien living among you who wants to celebrate the Lord's Passover must have all the males in his household circumcised, which was the Abrahamic covenant, remember. Then he may take part like one born in the land. Not an ethnic, it's not a genetic thing. No uncircumcised male may eat of it. The same law applies to the native born and to the alien living among you. The definition is not genetic, it is covenantal. If you take the covenant side, in that case it was circumcision. If you made that step with God, boom, you're in that circle. Boom. And all of these things you get participation of this. And if an alien, Numbers 15, and if an alien sojourns with you, or one who may be among you throughout your generations, and he wishes to make an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord, just as you do, so he shall do. As for the assembly, there shall be one statue for you and for the alien that sojourns with you, a perpetual statue throughout your generations. As you are, so shall the alien be before the Lord. There is to be one law and one ordinance for you and for the alien who sojourns with you. In other words, you could hang out here and be treated impartially by the God of Israel. Okay? It was open. It was open. And then this next one has got some serious typos in it, so if you've got it, the first line is really bad because it was a dactography problem, is what they call it. In Israel, for example, sacrifices were usually offered to God upon an altar, whereas in Mesopotamia, sacrifice was often presented without the use of an altar. Also, sacrifice in Mesopotamia was usually performed by priests using the wide range of offerings already presented to the temples, whereas in Israel, laymen had opportunity to sacrifice directly to God by bringing the victim to the altar and killing it there. Now, let me explain what that means. If I lived in Mesopotamia I would take routinely from my flocks and my vegetable garden and things of this type, I would go and give these to the priests. Right? They used it for the care and feeding of the God that was inside, remember? And so when it was time for a sacrifice, I wouldn't take anything in special. They would just use the inventory that they had. See? In other words, I am one step removed from them. Whereas in Israel, when I did something wrong, okay, I had offended somebody and I had done some destructive behavior, I literally would take an animal in, or money if I traveled too far in some cases, and I would literally go in and be part of that entire process. So there was an accountability element that was distinctive. It was more focused. It was more specific. I got more confronted with God in this process than I would have in just general Mesopotamia. Because I'm, like I say, I'm sort of out of the process. You know, I'm just part of the helpless public. Whereas in Israel, I got to do this on a very specific basis. I participated in these on a hands-on kind of basis. So that was a difference. 10 was the benevolence factor. At the end of every 3 years, bring all the tithes of that year's produce and store it in your towns. That's every 3 years. So that the Levites, who have no allotment or inheritance of their own, and the aliens, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns may come and eat and be satisfied, and so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. Okay? So a third of their tithe, at the end of every 3 years, they had a special offering, special tithe that came in. Okay? And it was just for those that had no means of support but were serving God, the Levites in this particular case, and the disadvantaged. Right? That's unusual in the ancient Near East. That's unusual in most religions, for that matter. Okay? That it would go for this, that these sacrifices were benevolent. They looked out. They were for building the community, for taking care of people's needs. 11, page 12, strong prohibitions against abuse, human sacrifice, and self-mutilation. Israel was not allowed to do this. They were specifically commanded not to. Leviticus 21, the Lord said to Moses, say to the Israelites, any Israelite or any alien, same law applies to both, living in Israel who gives any of his children to Molech must be put to death. Now, Molech was that temple that they had out in the, later to be the Valley of Hinnom. It was the Canaanite practice that they also applied later in some of the Greeks. They had a metal statue of Molech, this god with these hands that would heat red hot, and they would put the babies in those. This is what, and Israel did this later. They did the same thing. God told them, don't do what these people do, because I don't like that. You can understand why not. Okay? But, yep, Israel ended up doing it. The Canaanites did it. And the people of Tyre and Sidon did it as well. And that moved norward. Originally, that human sacrifice was confined to Syria, Palestine. But during the conquest, when Joshua and the Israelites came in to the land across the River Jordan and pushed these nations out, they pushed them basically north. They went up to Phoenicia. And the Phoenicians have the highest rate of human sacrifice religiously that we know of, other than those in the Andes Mountains that we talked about very early. So this was the practice that occurred, and God said, no, no, do not give your children to Moloch. If you do that, you will pay the consequence. Another one in Leviticus 19, do not cut your bodies for the dead or put tattoo marks on yourselves. I am the Lord. This was the ancestor cult, basically all the ancient. Remember we talked about that most of the big deities were dealt with by the official priest. And then most of the things that hassled us were household gods and ancestors that we were still felt really guilty about the way we treated them. Okay, and so we had to buy off all the lower echelon deities in Mesopotamia and Egypt, et cetera, things of this type, because the big ones had official people, official staff to take care of them. Okay, they had their own pages and all this stuff, right? And so in this case, he's trying to stop an ancestor worship kind of cult that does show up occasionally in Israel. They were doing this, and they continued to do this. Do not cut your bodies for the dead or put tattoo marks. 1 Kings 18:27, and it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied or gone aside, or is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be awakened. They should have used the crying baby technique. So they cried with a loud voice and cut themselves according to their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out on them. Now, some of you will remember this. It's quite a comical story. It's Elijah in the Old Testament confronting the 450 prophets of Baal. Right? Baal worship has taken over. The kingdom of Israel has been split into north and south. And in the north, you've got the rival cults against Yahweh. They've got, not only do they have just sort of idol worship, but they've got Baal, the big bad one, in there. And so Jezebel, who is this queen that's a daughter of a foreign nation, marries the local king, and she brings in, she's a powerful figure, brings in Baal worship, builds all these temples. And Elijah just and leads the whole nation astray, this kind of thing. So there's a confrontation between the single prophet of the Lord, according to him, Elijah, okay, and the 450 prophets of Baal, 450 prophets of Baal. And he issues a challenge. He says, look, Israel, make up your mind. You're sitting on the fence every single morning when you get up. You're sitting on the fence as to who's going to be God, you, Baal, or Yahweh, okay, and some mix between those. And so let's have a confrontation. Let's finally do this. Let's do this. They've had 3 years of drought. There's no water around anywhere. Let's have a fight. Let's issue a prayer. And the God that answers by fire, let him be God. Let's just go for a big sign this time. Okay? Let's just go for a big sign. And so they go out there. If you remember the story, they build a little altar, and they each put a bull on it, and they got the wood and all this kind of stuff. And the 450 prophets of Baal, oh, they start early in the morning, start dancing around, singing, doing all the religious rituals and all this kind of stuff, asking Baal to visit fire and to burn, consume the sacrifice. Right? Nothing happens. Elijah waits, looks at his sundial. You know, he's waiting on these folks, right? And so he taunts them at the end. Toward the end of the day, he taunts them. He says, and it came about at noon, Elijah mocked them and said, call out with a loud voice. You know, you're not talking loud enough. You're not screaming loud enough. He's a god. Either he's occupied or gone aside. And the gone aside is the Hebrew word for gone to the restroom. Right? Maybe he's gone aside to use the toilet. Right? Or he's on a journey. Remember, the deities, they left and they went places, so they were unavailable. Or perhaps he's asleep and needs to be awakened. So they cried with a loud voice. They cranked up the volume. And then they cut themselves, according to their custom, with swords and lances until the blood gushed out. This somehow got them more in this frenzy. And we don't know, as I mentioned before, we're not sure exactly what the significance of that was, other than perhaps whetting the appetite or something of this type of the deity. We don't know. But he mocks them. And if you remember the conclusion of the story, they do this until they just sort of get, and he says, then he says, let me show you. Let me show you the real God. Then he takes bats of water, remember? So he takes the water and remember, water is pretty scarce right at this time, right? And you can see a lot of people saying, well, you know, it's a waste of good water. Good. So he douses the bull and the wood, makes it all soaked so there's no accidental, spontaneous combustion. So nobody can say it has a fluke. It's a fluke, happens all the time. People spontaneous combust all the time, you know, right? And then he fills up the ditch around the thing with water. And then he orders, he issues like a 6-word prayer. Instead of all this vain repetitions and incantations, six or 7-word prayer. And fire comes from heaven. Remember, it consumes the sacrifice, the wood, the altar, burns up the altar itself, and then scorches all the earth and vaporizes all the water in the ditch. There's no question. Very unambiguous sign. Sort of like a resurrection. Or like a resurrection. You know, really big, unambiguous, relatively clear demonstration of his power. But the relevance here was about the cutting. God said, I don't want you to do this. This is how the nations around you do this. Don't want you to do this. Deuteronomy 14, you are the sons of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave your forehead for the sake of the dead. Okay. You could shave your forehead, presumably, if you were going to the military service, but this was for the dead. Okay, so the dead, you couldn't do this. And this was the point. You couldn't participate in this cult. You couldn't disfigure yourself. See? You couldn't alter what the appearance that God made us to be. And so there were prohibitions against abuse. 12, in spirit and in truth. Remember John 4, when the woman at the well encounters Jesus and he confronts her with her heart, and she wants to change the subject to argue about religion. So, well, you Jews worship in Jerusalem, but we worship. She tries to get him off the track, you know. And he says, well, truth. Look, the point is that God wants them to worship him in spirit and truth. See, cut to the quick. What's your heart? Where's your heart, right? What is the issue? Not rules and regulation, how often you go here and what do you do? You know, just where's your heart, spirit and truth? And this is what we saw in the psalmist and the prophets. Remember when we looked at how the abuses were, they were always going to the heart of the issue. That you won't be satisfied with my sacrifices unless my heart's in the right place. Matter of fact, if my heart's in the right place, sacrifices are good but not required. See, in this particular case. There was a big sacrifice that God had already applied, as it turns out. 13, this was a theological system, not just an ad hoc. The incantations that you see that grew up in the periods, this was just, there was no rhyme or ritual. We talked about the difference between a shaman and priesthood. Remember, a priestly religion had rules, and those sacrifices had to be offered in the following ways and things of this type. The shaman was an independent renegade. They would just do whatever, they would make it up on the fly, shoot from the lip kind of thing. And they would do this non-ritualized, but it was an independent kind of religious exercise. And it could vary from moment to moment, things of this type. In this one, God had built this whole system of, I'm after covenant loyalty. I want you to be kind to one another, so I'm going to build that into this system. I want to make sure in my sacrificial system, the widows, the fatherless, the oppressed, the aliens, and the Levites get food at least once every 3 years. And get the best of the land at least once every 3 years. See? In other words, there was a whole system of justice and righteousness. And we may get a chance to look at this, but it doesn't look like we will until we get through the introduction. And I commented last week that the thing that God seems to hate the most, remember, was treachery. And we'll have to look at the point about why there had to be sacrifices at all. You know, why couldn't God just say, let boys be boys, right? Why can't he just let it go? Why does God have to be just? See, why does God have to be right inside? Or is he a slave to his righteousness kinds of thing? See, why does he have to be right? And I've been pondering that for about at least a couple of years. And almost got the syllabus ready to inflict on you on that. But it fundamentally starts with the very character of God, that God is a community of persons to begin with as a part of the Trinity. If you could imagine the unthinkable, that somebody in the Trinity would betray one of the others in the Trinity, we're talking about the essence of God being split in half. See, justice is not an option to God. Right dealing with somebody, love, faithfulness, loyalty is part of who he is. See, this is not an optional law. I just make this up. You be that way. This is basically a fundamental part of God's character. And justice is just treating people as they deserve. In the case of the Trinity, it's easy. See, they're all beautiful. They're all great. They love one another. They're consistently promoting the other. The Father focuses on the Son. The Son focuses on the Father. The Spirit focuses upon them. We would know about the Holy Spirit if Jesus hadn't revealed him, you know. And so they're always out trying to give the glory to one another. Consider one another better than yourselves is what we're commanded to do. See, that kind of model. And treachery doesn't belong there. So you can only consistently, from a practical standpoint, focus on the needs of others exclusively when you know that there are other people that have the same position toward your needs. See? And you know there are other people looking out for you. Right? You are completely free. You're not even tempted to say, I got to look out for number one. See? You can focus on some other people, some other elements of the life. And that's the way the system is supposed to work. When it doesn't work, we have this entire sacrificial thing to remind us of how serious this was. And we're getting to that, and we're gonna run out of time today. So we're not going to get to that. At the bottom, we've got what this was all about. And so next week we'll have the what this was all about, what was the point of this, and the justice. But we're going to try to see if we can get through a couple of these points in the next 12 seconds. 14 was only the one God. This was a strictly monotheistic religion. You couldn't offer sacrifices to anybody but the one God. Over and over and over. And the Lord said to Moses, speak to Aaron and his sons and the Israelites and say to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Any Israelite who sacrifices an ox, a lamb, or a goat in the camp or outside of it, instead of bringing it to the entrance to present, shall be considered guilty of bloodshed. If he has shed blood, it must be cut off from the temple. And if you go through this, you see that basically the thing was that idolatry was bloodshed. Idolatry was bloodshed. Okay? God didn't honor that at all. In other words, for you to kill an animal out there, okay, your livelihood, in ways that weren't sanctioned by God, where people had benefits off of that. Remember the Thanksgiving offerings, things of this type? He said, that's waste. That's bloodshed. It's just not good to kill, period. So don't do this unless it's in a way that honors the community, the relationships, and the commitments that you've got. See? And this was a strictly monotheistic aspect. And the last point that would take us a couple of weeks to get through, if we did it right, was 15 was grace surrounding the law. And as you study through the Old Testament, you've got to realize that God has this point that he's trying to enforce upon us, trying to get across to us to take him seriously, right? That he gives us this owner's manual to life, you know, and if we will follow instructions, we'll do less pain. We'll have less pain. I learned a long time ago, it was so much easier to learn from the experience of others than it was to learn through my own personal experience. Much less painful. Follow instructions. Oops, I'm not going to do that one, God. Look what you did there. No way. Turn, go the other way. I mean, that's what this thing's, you know, one of the good things about this, right? So even during this time where he is constantly teaching, take law seriously. Take my moral law specifically seriously. We saw the true intent by the fact that grace was wrapped all around it. In other words, he did not, as the psalmist said, you don't really deal with us according to our sins or else we'd be totally consumed. If you look at the Old Testament, there's so many cases, and I just list a couple there. Stone tablets. Remember the first 10 commandments came down right in the middle when they had just gotten the high point of idolatry? They just built the two golden calves, threw them down, God chiseled some more with his finger. Aaron and the death of his oldest sons, they're cranking off the Aaronic priesthood, and he's supposed to eat the burnt offering, and his sons get killed for offering, you know, pagan sacrifice there at the temple, and he doesn't fulfill the burnt offering that he's supposed to, and Moses goes to him upset, said, why didn't you follow the law? He said, my kids died. Would God be honored with me giving thanks today? And God told Moses, he's right. He's right. Cut him some slack. In extenuating circumstances, there's grace. A variation in sacrifice cost, the fact that somebody had to offer a lamb, but somebody could do, the poor people could offer something different. That's grace. That's pure grace. The second month Passover, if you went to do the Passover that you were supposed to and you weren't clean, you could come back next month. He said, I got a fallback clause. I'll have a second makeup for the test, you know, for you people that miss it somehow. And that's just pure grace. So you don't have to do that. And the other deities of the ancient Near East wouldn't have done that. David and the showbread, Jesus used this, remember? He's fleeing from Saul, he's chasing his life. He goes into where the priest has got the tabernacle and stuff like that back in those days. And he's hungry. And he says, do you have any bread? And he says, I don't have any regular bread. All I got is the holy bread, which nobody can eat. And he does the showbread. Jesus uses this as an example of saying, let's put the Sabbath was not, you know, man was not made for the Sabbath, but the Sabbath made for man. Atonement by incense, placement of Aaron in the plague of Korah and Dathan. This is a much longer story, but this was completely against all of the laws. Aaron was not supposed to leave the tabernacle. Sacrifice was only by blood, and yet to stop this huge plague that would have decimated most of Israel, Aaron ran out into the middle of the crowd and offered this incense, and God said, okay, we'll stop it. And he didn't kill Aaron, and he didn't kill the rest of the Israelites. Just said, okay. The later Passovers, in the late monarchy, the kings were having to pray. We're not clean, we're not ready, but please accept our heart. And God did. God did. Ruth, Rahab, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many of these. It's just the message was there. I just want you to take this seriously. These are for your good. Don't go doing this. Okay? But there was grace all around this. It all looked forward, of course, to the death of Christ so that he could be a demonstration of righteousness for the sins previously committed. But that's a subject of another syllabus. But I do want to just remind you that this all is prep work for the supreme sacrifice in the person of Jesus Christ, where God said, at this rate, you won't be able to do it yourself. To put it kindly, by the way. In other words, you're going in the other direction. The phrase, there's a little good in somebody, means there's a lot of bad in most folk, right? So I'm going to come myself, and I'm going to resolve the issue within myself so that I am completely just and free to accept the feeblest openness and jumping, falling back in the fog when you don't understand the circles and the chairs and the terminology, and you say, if I can just get to Jesus, I'll be okay. Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you that you just you are so patient with us, and you just put the cookies on the bottom shelf that we can have them, so we can reach them with our little arms. And we just ask that we would just cling to Jesus this week, recognize that he is just the complete satisfaction of all these requirements that we could never do. We thank you for him. Thank you that he carries the nail prints in his hand to remind us consistently of what he did for us, the love that sent the Passover lamb to free us from the bondage, that we can walk in newness of life. So we pray that we would fall in love with him more and be loyal. Help us avoid treachery this week. Help us not be treacherous people. Bless us as we look at this, as we finish up the series next week. May we honor you this week as we walk forward. And thank you for showing us your heart on a consistent basis. Amen.